know if Nuna counts as towards the quorum and can vote?
Yes, because
designee of the meeting.
Okay, so then we do have a quorum.
Okay. One thing I don't know lore in the river experience. Whenever anyone who's heard, there's a lot of echo.
There's a lot of echo.
If there's an extra laptop that needs to be included.
I think it's probably our mic in the room with the echo.
Do you want me to speak again?
Do you want me to speak again?
Yeah, it's echoing. We'll manage it, but I don't know if anyone else wants to hear it.
Maybe try echo cancel.
How is that, Kat? Is that okay? Oh, perfect. Okay.
Great.
But I think the test is when worse is when worse. Yeah. See, and I'm hearing myself, and then I'm hearing myself come through your mic.
I think if someone's speaking online, you probably have to mute your mic.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so for anyone who is online when you are speaking, we'll just mute the microphone on our end, so hopefully that prevents any feedback. So thank you for your patience and just for working through this with us.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Glad everybody's here. This is the Utah Multicultural Commission meeting on Tuesday, January 13th. We are going to start out with a review of the minutes. Did everyone have a chance to review the minutes? Or at least attempt to? I'm going to take that as a yes. There's a number of nods. Can we have a roll call here? I'll name everybody off. Luna?
Or can we get an approval first and then
can we get
a second?
Approval
yeah.
Of the minutes.
Make a motion.
Sorry.
Make a motion. We need a second.
And then we need a second.
This is Rihanna Medina online.
Wonderful. We've got the motion made, and then we've got a second. Are there any nays? Wonderful. We'll move forward.
And then we do have to do a roll call.
And we do have to do a roll call. Yeah. That's what I was so excited about, the roll call. I used the cheat sheet here, too. Let's go through the roll call now. We've got, is Luna available online?
No.
Emmy?
I approve.
Wonderful. Tracy.
This is Nuna Phillips. I'm here on behalf of Tracy.
Yeah. My name down is extra too. So you're thinking for Tracy, right? Just let her choose some place. Rihanna.
Present.
No. Me, I'm a yes. Kevin?
Yes.
Rich.
Yes.
Wonderful. Tom, I don't see Tom online. And I always mispronounce your name.
Terras?
Yes. Approved.
Wonderful. And we have a couple of guests today, too.
And then Meredith.
Is Meredith? I don't see Meredith. Oh, okay. Meredith?
Somebody up there?
No?
Okay.
Guests that are here with us, of course, I call them leaders. Jenny, Dustin, Igor, Pat, and Jeremy. Glad you're here. Is Jeremy here as well? No. All righty. And moving forward.
I'm a different kind of guest.
And we have, next we're going to start off the conversation on the Commissioner vacancy, correct?
Yep.
Igor, can we let you take that? Because I've been reviewing the applications, and it's spectrum is wide.
Yeah.
But I want to get your insights.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've had a great turnout so far for the one commission seat that's open. And we are going to be doing interviews at the start of February. Thank you, Rihanna, for the delay and working with us as we figure out everyone's schedule. But that also means that there's still time if there is someone else who you'd like to recommend applies for the commission seat. Please feel free to recommend that they do that. So we'll probably stop accepting applications probably the first week of February. So from now till then, feel free to recommend. Nuna.
Is there a specific type of perspective that you're hoping for to fill that vacancy?
What we're, and just a question, is that echo gone when we mute? Okay, wonderful. Thank you, Jenny. So what's really important with this commission seat is connection to communities in Utah. And so the question is, what are some of the communities that are already well represented on this commission? And what are some of the communities that we feel we're missing, that we don't have direct access to? So the whole idea is that we should hopefully be able to disseminate information to different communities across Utah and folks who've got great connections to those individuals is what we're looking for. Also, who are fun to work with. We want to be able to enjoy ourselves while we're on the commission, so folks who you enjoy working with and spending time with, too. Should I just jump into my second?
Yeah,
okay. So I also wanted to give you an update on the deputy director that we're hiring for the Division of Multicultural Affairs. We just closed that on Thursday. We had 187 applicants. And so thank you so much for sharing that. We are very excited to start going through them. It is a huge amount of applicants, and we're excited at the opportunity to find a great deputy. That deputy will eventually be the person who is going to be running these meetings as well. And so they're going to be really involved in both the commission for the Martin Luther King Human Rights Commission and for the Multicultural Commission. They'll also be working on our youth events. Any questions about that?
When people were submitting their names, did they talk about the interest they had, why they wanted to be the deputy?
So we've got a special process at the state where we start with a blind review of just their resume.
Okay.
And so once we go through their resume without the names are taken off, the address is taken off, and so we first do a pass of all of them, and then the ones that we then pass from there, they'll get an interview, and then we can read their cover letter, and we can go through that process.
So the 180 will be on the blind.
Yes.
Ooh, easy.
Yeah.
A few for you.
Thank you. Yeah, it'll take up a lot of our time and bandwidth. And also say that if anyone wants to be involved for the final round interview, which will be a presentation, please let me know. We would love to have you as part of that. We're not expecting you to be part of the 180 review or even part of that kind of first interview that'll be probably 15 to 20 minute conversation with candidates, but we'll have three rounds. The third round will be a presentation. And if you're interested in being a part of that, please let me know.
I'd love to do that. I've done it once before for the commission. So it's
yeah, great. I think a few of you were on mine not too long ago. Any more questions about that? Okay. I'll pass it over to Jenny to talk a little bit about developing bylaws.
Yeah, so when I came on to support Igor with the Multicultural Commission, our team realized that the commission has never actually adopted bylaws, and so I have drafted something for the commission to review and then hopefully approve in the near future. I know Igor is going to be discussing some scheduling, and so hopefully at the March meeting, you're able to take some time and adopt those. Basically, the administrative rules allow the commission to create bylaws for administrative and internal operations. And so it kind of goes over, you know, the membership, the co-chair positions roles, and then for emergency meetings, the like. So it kind of just provides additional structure to, you know, the meeting structure and membership. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer that as well. But otherwise, I think it's pretty straightforward. And again, I'm hoping to send that to you within the next month for everyone's review.
And currently it's being reviewed by our legal team just to make sure we're putting it all together properly. And then we'll send it to you all. We're also adding a, can't remember what it's called, but basically not really attendance requirement. That sounds very, very high school, but basically just an agreement that, commissioners will attend 75% of the meetings, just to make sure we do have active participation from all of our commissioners. Questions on that before we move on?
No, I think that's a good thing to do. We find that more and more now.
Yeah.
And I won't go into it, but yeah.
Well, we appreciate everybody who's here, and we really just want to be able to put that down on paper so we can hold each other accountable for it. I also just wanted to give a quick summary of, we've been talking about our newsletters and outreach over the last couple of meetings. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of information on some of the numbers that we pulled. Jenny, could you go to the next slide?
Yes.
So we've been talking about our newsletters that we were putting together in the past, and if that was something we wanted to continue doing. And I just wanted to pull the information of who those were going out to and the response we were getting. So they were going out to 56 people, and a little more than half were opening them, and then not very many people were clicking them. And so in thinking about what we want to be working on in the future, I just wanted to give us a little bit of information and data around who those were going out to and if they were being utilized, which from the numbers, it doesn't seem like we were getting very high adoption. And so I would just say that if we are going to be doing something which is intended to be sending out to a broad audience, we should probably give some pause and a little bit of thought around what is going to be the best way to disseminate that information, because the way we've been doing newsletters in the past doesn't really seem to be hitting the audience that we want.
What is the standard for newsletters?
What do you mean by standard?
Like a standard open versus click rate.
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know.
Because I actually think it might be decent.
Sure.
Compared to an average standard.
Yeah, I think 64% is great as a standard. I just don't think 36 people is the amount that we want to be reaching. But I do think the percentage of who we're reaching isn't too bad. Yeah. Any questions on that?
No, you know, I made comments last time we had this discussion. This doesn't show you when it is shared, right?
It will show us the clicks.
It'll show the clicks.
Yeah.
The shares.
But we can't see if it's been shared, because it was basically on our, we were then sending it out, and then people were coming to the website to click through.
Okay. Would it be possible to, and I don't know what the state regs are, to be able to share it on like Instagram and Facebook? Because then it can be shared and disseminated to all sorts of folks.
Yeah.
I know LinkedIn is another one that, you know, I've shared it on LinkedIn many times.
Yeah.
You don't really get a lot of responses there, but Facebook for the community groups, you know, for me, I've got a plethora of them.
Yeah.
And it's a nice way to be able to do it. But the way it is now, I can't copy it and paste it.
Yeah.
It just changes everything when I try that.
Yeah.
But that may be something we want to look at.
Yeah. So we'll continue to look at, if we are going to be disseminating information, what are the different ways we could do it that would reach a bigger audience, and that we could try. Any other questions about that? Okay, wonderful. I just wanted to give also a quick update about the Literacy Summit. Could you actually go to the next? So I was able to go to the governor's literacy symposium. Sean was there as well. Dr. Nye was there as well. Kat was there as well. And I just wanted to share, you know, this is a big focus. If you all saw the article in the Deseret News, less than half of the kids in the state of Utah are on reading level.
Is that third grade?
Third grade reading, yeah. And I think a lot of folks already know this, but third grade is a really important marker, because it's when kids go from learning to read to reading to learn. So if they aren't on track on third grade, There's a lot of studies that show that they're less likely to graduate high school, they're less likely to go to college, they're more likely to end up incarcerated. And so it really is just a pivotal time where we don't want students to fall behind. So across the state of Utah, all students are below grade level. Once you look at that disaggregated data and you start to see how English language learners are doing, that's at 15% at the beginning of the year, goes up to 18% by the end of the year. You know, African-American students, American Indian students, Asian students, definitely higher than the rest. But when you look at the numbers, to me, it shows that this is an area where this commission could have a lot of impact on, because we are intentionally the group that is trying to reach out to communities across the state. And I think we have the possibility of giving a message to different communities in ways that are more nuanced, more individualized, and actually give us an opportunity to make an impact with these communities. So
what's Acadian Sleeping?
What's the what?
The title, Above Benchmark on Acadians.
You know, that's a great question. Dr. Nye, do you know what that means? I was looking at that when I pulled this from USBE, and I wasn't sure either.
Yeah, so this is the stuff I live, right? So Acadience is the tool that is used. It serves as an assessment, but also a progress monitoring resource that tracks how students are responding to intervention, right? So if they are struggling readers, the school will implement some type of intervention, and then they are able to determine through Acadience, right, as a platform, how well they're progressing. So Acadience as an assessment, is administered at the beginning of the year, middle of the year, end of the year that you see. So it really is just an assessment and a resource, for teachers to, track how students are progressing.
Is this something that's implemented at select schools or across all schools?
Across the state. So, in SB 127 in 2022, it doubled down on that, for some efforts that even in 2016, the legislature said, hey, we need this early literacy, platform and the tools associated with it available across all of our schools. So it's not even an opt-in. It's a state law to use. So.
So can parents opt out, or do parents have to sign something to allow their kid to take this assessment?
Yeah, so there is a parental rights in this space does allow them to opt out. When that does come out, parents generally don't opt out of Acadience. They certainly will opt out of RISE, you know, the end of level assessments in those content areas. But Acadience, given its utility, has a very low percentage of opt out.
Commissioner Gardner, do you have something?
Yeah, just a follow-up question for Dr. Nye. Thank you. So looking at this graph, can you let us explain to us what would then comprise the limited English proficiency group, separate from where we've listed African American, American Indian, Asian, Hispanic, White, and Pacific Islander? Is that just all other potential culturally different groups, or?
Yeah, so the limited English proficiency, we have students who where English is a second language, they may have already tested out, meaning they've gained enough of a grasp of the English language per some of the other resources that the schools have. We use in our state an assessment called WIDA that helps determine English language proficiency. And so that limited English proficiency are for those students who would qualify for that other assessment to help them increase in their English proficiency. What I don't know in these data as currently presented is if the limited English proficiency group that's listed there is controlling for someone in the Hispanic student group. Meaning, and when I run these data, I would do both, right? So Hispanic as it takes a look there, and it's a little small on my screen. There we go. At 32.2% at the end of the year, does that also include those students that are limited to English proficiency, or were the limited English proficiencies removed out of the denominator of that Hispanic student group? You know, anyone that qualified for both. My guess is it is that to where you still see, by comparison, you know, this, 23 point, less proficient for the Hispanic students. And then the limited English proficiency is at 18%. So does that answer the question? So as a student group, those that are learning English for the first time, English as a second language, they're receiving those services. That's the percent of them that are proficient, which actually, as you can imagine, that it's, if you already have limited English proficiency and you're still reaching proficiency, that's still a low number, but these are students that literally are learning English, for the first time. But I believe those are removed from like the other, categories, or student groups.
Got it. No, thank you. That is super helpful. I appreciate it.
I have a question follow up with the limited English proficiency. What's the level that's considered limited? Like, do you have to be above a level 3, level 4? And what scale do you use?
Yeah, so there's WIDA in the associated English language development tiers. If a student, you know, level one, you're just starting to learn some English, and there's different categories or reporting categories and associated standards with these, and they just progress, right? So they level out after level five, meaning they've tested out essentially of receiving English language development services because they're proficient enough orally and in writing at grade level, and these are bands across grade levels, to where they don't need those English language development services anymore. So it's kind of a 1 through 5 scale. But even if a student is they're still considered limited English proficiency because they're still receiving services.
Thank you, Dr. Nye. I know we're putting you on the spot right here.
No, I live it, so I'll ask any question.
I'm also wondering, is there anything you want to add about the symposium or the governor's initiative that might be helpful for this commission to know about?
Certainly. This is going to be a top priority for the governor, First Lady, Lieutenant Governor Henderson, moving forward, working with Senator Milner right now on some language for this second iteration, if you will, this large iteration of prioritizing literacy across our state. And the expectations are high, but this piece of legislation is going to come as it's drafted, as we're working through, you know, the financials with the legislature as that starts Tuesday. But anyway, it will come with significant resources for intervention for K-3 students. And so, as has already been mentioned, when we have struggling readers in first grade, let's get them on an individualized reading plan early. And we're going to tailor some very specific interventions for the child and for the family, which is going to be significant, depending on the needs of the family. Sometimes you have a family, as has been mentioned, who they're learning English themselves. And so they might go to a community center or a community school after hour, and they're learning English too. So we're going to tailor intervention to individual students and their families. That will be part of this bill. Another part of this bill, in addition to reading interventionists in school, family resources, you're going to have a very large philanthropic and nonprofit commitment for those resources. Which will be significant, and that there'll be a piece in the bill that will likely address, how that's to be done. Oftentimes philanthropic resources, always gratefully received, are one-time funds, but we're looking at even options for what does it look like for an ongoing revenue source, given the public-private partnerships that might exist. So we're working on that, which would affect families, not just, you know, students in school, but families in their homes. So, there's going to be a lot more to come on this. We just have a lot of work to do in this space, and it'll be a priority not only for this session but for the rest of Governor Cox's second term.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, please.
Dr. I get to work a lot with English language schools across the valley, and I know they've had been experiencing a lot of funding cuts, which they have to cut staff. Would this legislative bill bring in funding for these schools? Because it is important for, you know, third graders to learn English and improve their proficiency, but it's parents who are going to be helping the kids with this. And if the parents can also be more supported in learning English. I think it will also help the kids learn English as well.
Yeah, there's a big part of that. There's two parts. One is the certainly the philanthropic, identifying what families need. But that's from community to community, right? So it looks very, very different for a student at Montezuma Creek in San Juan, part of the, you know, the Navajo Nation and the reservation, to be able to say, hey, what resources does that community need versus a West Valley community need? And so what you'll see more than likely in this bill is an application for resources, meaning if there was a fiscal allocation and a school identifies what their needs are, what their family needs are, then they tailor what their application is to provide those resources to meet that need. So it's not so much a just kind of a one size fits all statewide approach. It's going to be tailored to what individual schools need because they are so different. And their families as well. So two-prong approach, school resources and resources within the community and within the homes. And I'll just bring up one other piece. You've probably heard Governor Cox talk about third grade retention. If a student's not at reading on grade level at third grade, at what point do we necessitate a conversation and say, well, it may be in the best interest of a child if they didn't get promoted to the fourth grade, but they repeated a grade. As you can imagine, it's kind of controversial. Many other states have already have gone down this road. We're just exploring the option. And honestly, when people think of retention, they're already thinking, well, we're going to retain 50% of the third grade students, you know, next year. That wouldn't work. And so Governor Cox isn't necessarily going there, but we're saying, well, if we have that first grade student who started the school year well below, they ended the school year well below, what is the obstacle to their progressing? So let's initiate some dyslexia screeners. We know that for about 70 to 80% of the first grade students at the end of the school year that are well below their literacy goals, that 70 to 80% have some form of dyslexia that they're working through, some reading ability to read and have that literacy and in terms of that obstacle. And then we tailor resources to whatever that is for the child. So you're going to see that. The idea is if we get our interventions right in K1, 2, 3, then holding a child back in third grade, we aren't doing that because our interventions. And that's where the resources are so essential for intervention in the younger grades to make sure that we reach the vast majority of our students by the time they reach third grade that we're not holding them back in third grade. With that, other states have, and we're looking at what are called good cause exemptions, a GCE, right? Education just needs one more acronym. Here we go. A good cause exemption or a GCE would be for, some students that would qualify that says, hey, given these circumstances, you're going to get promoted to the fourth grade, even though you may not be where we would like you to be in terms of or relation to your literacy goals. So as you can think about the student, the student that comes into the classroom in third grade, they're moving from out of the country. They're still learning English for the first time, including identifying letters in the alphabet. We're not going to retain that student indefinitely, clearly. There's going to be a good cause exemption that we're going to continue to provide this student with some English language development services in fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth grade and until they test out. So there's some latitude in it to where it makes some sense for individual students to continue to be socially promoted that it's going to use some permissive language and not necessarily doing, a statewide blanket approach.
Nuna, go ahead.
Thank you, Rich. This has all been incredibly helpful. I wanted to put out to this group, I represent DHHS on the Promise Partnership Council, and one of the four goals that we have there is to help support multi-language learners. I was just pulling up some of our materials, and I believe, if memory serves, the focus there is on maybe the older students. I know they have like some initiatives happening at East High School. So I would just suggest that if we as a multicultural commission want to venture into like helping to promote strategies in this area, that maybe the Promise Partnership Council is a place that we can join forces so that we're not duplicating efforts or siloing efforts and really coming together to jointly support Director Nye and USB and others who are working in this space.
Yeah, Nuno, that's a great point. The Premise Partnership Council is also working currently with Senator Fillmore on what's called the REACH Act. And again, that stands for something. But anyway, it's really aligning what our community resources put after very specific needs. And so for an East High, they've identified where they have some secondary literacy concerns among some of their students. They're also, I think it's a great point. Okay, how do we, if we have this other piece of legislation running, it would be complementary to this literacy piece if a community were to decide, hey, this is the priority that we need in our schools right now. So it's a point well taken. And I would say watch for that bill as it develops, because it very much is a community-based approach to identify what are very specific problems of practice, if you will, and leverages resources to address those.
Thank you, Dr. Nye. Chair House, go ahead.
My question is for Noon. Do we have the Promise Partnership Initiative up here in Northern Utah and Logan specifically? I know we have a Logan School District has a good number of students, multicultural, from multicultural communities, but I haven't heard about any of those initiatives up here.
Yeah, we haven't met as a full council in a while, and I had to miss the last sort of subgroup meeting. I want to say for that particular strategy around literacy for multi-language learners, the work was really focused at East High School. There are other initiatives that the Promise Council is working on that are across more geographic areas, but I believe that one is specific to East High School.
What? Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say United Way Northern Utah might be an interesting group to connect with. Terras. They're based out of Ogden, but I know they do a lot of work up north, up into Logan as well, I believe. I don't know if you've ever connected with them, but happy to connect you.
Yes, sure.
Thanks.
Well, I really appreciate all the energy that's around this, and thank you, Dr. Nye, for the impromptu session. I will take the initiative to reach out to Promise Partnership. We obviously have, you know, Sean, who is really involved, Nuna, who is really involved. There's quite a lot of crossover. And so I'll do some outreach to them. And I also used to work at United Way. And so we can start the conversation around what specifically they're working on that we could possibly cross over and work with them. Particularly through that lens of literacy for language learners and through a multicultural lens, including language access, cultural outreach. And so we can start that conversation and maybe at the next meeting, maybe have someone from that group, talk about what they're working on and possible, overlap. Okay. Kat, can I pass it to you to talk a little bit about the legislative session?
Of course. It's a great day, actually. Hi, everyone. I'm Kat Potter. I am the Deputy Director for the Department of Cultural and Community Engagement, CCE, which is the overarching agency that MCA is a part of. And along with my Executive Director and partner, Donna Law, who I know many of you have met and interacted with, we oversee 9 divisions within CCE. And we also act as the liaisons to the governor's office, lieutenant governor's office, and to the legislature during session. So first of all, I want to make sure you know that I am a resource to you anytime. Igor has my contact information, and I'm on these meetings as often as I can be. But as we enter into the legislative session next Tuesday for the next couple of months, if anything comes up and you have questions, I'm happy to connect with you anytime about specific bills, whether they relate to the commission or not. So just know that I'm here as a resource to you. Specifically about the legislative session, as Dr. Nye mentioned, we will be following everything related to literacy, because that's not only something that could potentially be a real focus for the commission here, but also for MCA as a whole and for many of our other divisions in CCE. We have the Utah State Library Division, the Division of Arts and Museums, the Utah Historical Society, the Division of Indian Affairs are all part of our agency. So our connections with communities and all of those levels, you know, we talked about not doing things in duplicating efforts of things like the Promise Program. We also don't want to duplicate efforts that are happening within our own agency or within state government. So how can we build upon each other and complement each other and work together to have a better impact, particularly on literacy? So we'll be following all of those bills and budget requests related to literacy. Our role really, as many of you know who are state leaders or state employees on this call, as state employees, we advocate for items that are in the governor's budget and hope for those to be funded. CCE and MCA don't really have many budget requests this year that are in the governor's budget. We have a small one-time request for USERV Utah, which is our division that manages service and volunteerism. They have a program, a new pilot program called Volunteer for Good, which encourages service with high school students. We have a one-time request to expand some of their programming and database usage to encourage more students to volunteer in their communities. So that is our only budget request. So we are mostly going to be sitting back and watching and responding to bills as they come up. We're early on. We don't have all, some of the bills have dropped. Many of them have not. We've heard that it'll be another record year for bills, so we will see what is to come. So we will be monitoring that. We have a legislative liaison in our office who's our director of operations who works very closely with Donna and with me. And we will keep our division directors, including Igor, up to date on anything that might be impactful for multicultural communities, or any of the work that you're doing. And we'll, of course, update you by email as needed. We've gotten the question before about a bill tracker. We do an internal bill tracker, but we don't have an external bill tracker on our website, either for CCE or for MCA. And the reason for that is that really there are so many bill trackers out there from our community partners, so we're often directing people to look at our community partners, some of the nonprofit groups that are involved in the advocacy space who are tracking bills. We don't take formal positions on bills that come through, but we're here to educate. So if a legislator or a committee wants to get more information that's relevant to any of our divisions, including statistics that we might have through some of the work that we've done with MCA, then we're there too. We can testify, we can educate on those, but we don't take a formal position and advocate for or against any bills. Of course, as individuals, you are welcome to do so as individual citizens. That is your right to be involved in the legislative process however you wish, but we do also ask that you not try to represent the commission as a whole when you're doing legislative work as an individual. So just make sure that you draw a distinction between your role as a commissioner and your role just as an individual in the community. That's a general overview as we jump into session, but if you have any questions about the session, you can either ask me now or reach out to me separately anytime.
Any questions for Kat before we move on? Okay. Thank you, Kat. So I'm going to pass it over to Cassandra, who is our 211 representative today. We had talked a lot about 211 at our last meeting, and Cassandra was kind enough to come join our meeting and give us a little bit of an overview.
That's great, Cassandra. Awesome. Thank you. I'm not sure if there's a way to make it full screen. Is it just down here? Is that it? Yes. Okay. And then just so that we can see everyone, if you can just, it doesn't have that option. Never mind. You will have to just use this screen to just.
Perfect. Yep. Thank you. All right. Folks online, if you have any questions, I can't see you. So please go ahead and verbally let me know that you have a question so that I can pop over and mute ourselves to hear your questions. Thank you. It is an honor to be here today. My name is Cassandra Wambach, and I am the Senior Director of Service Navigation with 211 Utah, part of the United Way of Salt Lake. Prior to that, I spent almost 4 years with the Department of Cultural and Community Engagement, reporting to CAT. So it's great to be back in this space. Thank you for having me.
It sounds like maybe everyone is familiar with 211, at least generally what it is. So 211 is a resource hub. You can dial the number 211 and someone will help you get connected to resources in your local area to help you meet your basic needs. That is true anywhere in the country, not just in Utah. Every state has a 211 team that will answer phone calls and help people get connected to local resources. And so, as is a surprise to no one on this call, service delivery can be incredibly chaotic. There are lots of different resources, but eligibility varies. People don't know how to get connected. Where do applications live? And so 211 is designed nationally to help people navigate what can be a very chaotic space. For us here in Utah, we have a system that works together to provide 211 resources across the state. So here in Salt Lake, we have the United Way of Salt Lake that has a 211 team of 15 folks who are answering calls from the community and managing our resource database. And then in Southern Utah, out of the United Way of Central and Southern Utah, they have a 211 team as well. And those folks respond to clients from south of Salt Lake, and we manage everyone in the northern part of the state. Our office ends up taking about 80% of the call volume just because of the way the population in Utah is distributed. The United Way of Northern Utah used to have their own 211 team, but due to funding, we absorbed their service area. And so now we just work very closely with them to make sure that we represent their communities and their resources well. There are a lot of different ways to connect with 211. If you are someone in the community who needs help getting access to resources, you can call 211. The number of times that people ask me 211, or is that the call before you dig people, is incredibly surprising, but no, we are the 211 people you can call to help get connected to resources. We also have an 888 number, if that's better for folks. You can text us at that mobile number. You can chat us via our website, and you can email us as well. All of those different communication channels will get you sent to our incredible team of service navigators that I have the privilege to oversee, and then they will help that client get connected to resources. Also, people can connect with us on social media. They can walk into our office and we will get them connected to a service navigator or via the website or the app. So lots of different ways to connect with 211, but about 90% of our interactions end up coming through the phone, people just calling. And what is it that we do? We manage a database of service providers, which is no small task for anyone who's ever tried to make or keep up to date a resource list. We have over 3,000 organizations that provide over 10,000 services that we manage in our database. We keep all of this information in Salesforce. That's what we use for our database. So when you call 211 here in Utah, you get connected to someone who has access to that full database of information. And we offer this support in over 200 languages. So our team in person, we have folks who speak Spanish and English, but we have a language line that we have access to that anyone can call us in need of any language and we'll be able to offer that support via a translator on the phone. And 211 is more than a hotline. So over the past year or so, our 211 out of the United Way of Salt Lake and the United Way of Central and Southern Utah realized that what 211s have historically done isn't meeting people's needs. Historically, 211s answer the phone, say, where do you live? What do you need? And we give you the phone number for the local resource that might be able to help you get that need met. But it wasn't really cutting it. People weren't calling, weren't getting connected, weren't having the right eligibility requirements met, so they weren't even eligible for the service we connected them to. And so we've completely restructured the way that our team works. And so one of the things that we did is we used to have two teams of people. We had people who managed that provider database of over 3,000 providers, and we had a team of people that worked with clients in the community. And we were finding that we were consistently referring people to the same resources over and over. And the thought was, well, maybe if those people knew more about the resources, they would refer to a wider breadth of resources. And we were right. That has happened over the past year. So now the same group of people is doing both those bodies of work. When our service navigators receive a call, they are also asking additional questions. So you call and say that you need help getting access to food. They're going to help you with that. And they're also going to say, do you have kids who need access to healthcare? If you need help getting access to food, are your utilities paid? And we're going to try to dig deeper about what other needs someone might have. And we're also going to take that eligibility into consideration so that we're not referring people to places that they can't receive the service. Another thing we're doing is offering warm transfers to everyone who's contacting us. So when we say, oh, great, Utah Community Action might be able to help you get that rental assistance that you need, would you like us to call them with you right now to make sure you get connected to a person? And that significantly increases the chances that that person is going to get connected and going to get what they need because we made sure they got there in the first place. And then another change that we've made is we are following up with our goal is 100%. I think we're at about 92% of the clients that are contacting us. And so those clients that we're not connecting with, it's because they're not consenting to us following up with them, and therefore we're not going to bother them. But either by text or phone call within a week after they connect with us, we're saying, hey, we connected you with these services. Did you get what you needed? If you didn't, let's connect again so that we can talk about what other options exist to make sure that you get that need met that you called us for. And so all of that work revolves around keeping our resource database updated because we need to make sure that we have the correct opening hours, eligibility requirements, locations for all of these service providers. So for all of those 3,000 service providers across the state, we are updating that information at least once a year. For the top like 40% of our providers that we refer to more often, we're updating that at least 4 times a year. So we're very committed to making sure that the information we have is accurate so that we are making good and effective referrals for people.
So it's not a question. So my company helps connect people to education programs. We try to provide wraparound services. Obviously, it's not recreate resource data banks. And so do you ever work with like a CBO like, to help? Like if my navigators are referring the client to you all, for you all to help navigate service referrals, is there a way for us to then connect so that to learn like where this person's at in their journey?
So that's a great question. At this point, we do not have privacy confidentiality agreements with our clients that we would be able to share their information with you. However, we have different partnerships where we do get that consent. So for example, right now, in collaboration with the Promise Partnership, we are building a service referral hub for folks who are in a Granite School District school and live in South Salt Lake and or Mill Creek to join a referral hub where approved providers that they consent to can track the referrals they've made, what the outcomes of those referrals were, and see where they have gone in their journey, read the notes from our navigators to see more about their story and what their needs were. We have a partnership right now with The Road Home where we've gotten consent from clients to compare their data to understand what their experience of homelessness has been and what supports have been beneficial. So as a blanket statement, no, we take confidentiality very seriously, but are there opportunities for those types of partnerships? Yes. Thank you for that question. So as an example of the partnerships and just the reason that we value our partners so much, we really value two-way communication in the closed-loop referral process. So let's say that someone calls us and they need help getting food. They say, we need a food pantry. We don't know where our local one is. We say, great, ABC Food Pantry is near you. This is where it is. This is its hours of operation. That client goes, and it turns out they couldn't find it. So when we follow up with them within a week and say, hey, did you get the food you needed? And that client tells us, actually, I couldn't find it. You gave me the location, but I didn't know where to go in. I wasn't sure if they were open. What we're going to do then is, A, we're going to make sure that we either help them get to that location or get food somewhere else in their local area, right? But we're also going to follow up with that food pantry and say, hey, we sent a client here, and they said there wasn't a sign. Do you know if you have signage outside that maybe didn't get put out that day or if that's something that we could troubleshoot? Because we want to make sure that if we're sending people somewhere, it's effective for both the client and for that provider because that provider lost the opportunity to do something helpful for that client. And so meeting with our providers and making sure that we are doing our best in making referrals and offering any feedback is really important to us. And as I mentioned, we're meeting with all of our providers at least once a year to be managing this update process. If anyone here is one of the providers that lives in our database, thank you for responding to our incessant emails and phone calls about needing to keep you updated. It really helps us do our jobs better. Another thing to know is that anyone who calls 211 will answer 11 universal questions if they consent. This helps us create an account for them so that we don't have to ask them these same questions every time they call us. And what this does is it really helps us determine the eligibility that folks have. So where they live, dates of birth, children in the household, disability status, all of this is going to help us understand what services people are eligible for and can be available to them.
So if a client gets services like Brad, you follow up a week later? And does Brad have the ability to, like, reach out in the middle of the week?
Yes.
Oh, so it's, like, bi-directional.
Anyone can always call 211. Oh. Any one of us could call 211 right now. And so we will follow up with Brad within a week of when we originally spoke with him, but Brad can call us back at any time.
Gotcha. And it won't be, it would just be, like, whoever is on service for that day, right? It wouldn't be Cassandra.
Correct, yes. And so we do have, again, some different partnerships where we have direct contacts for different organizations. And it's something that helps people feel a little more connected, right? Like, I know I'm getting Cassandra when I call, and that's important.
Yeah.
But the way that we train our team and the way that our database creates accounts for folks, any person on our team, any service navigator, is fully capable of taking any client that has worked with us before and having the information needed to be able to help them. So if I got someone today, I could say, oh, it looks like Dora spoke with you last week and referred you to these places. Are you calling about that? Or do you have a new need that we didn't capture at that time? And our service navigation team, as I've mentioned, is incredible. We have a little quote here from one of our navigators saying that being a 211 service navigator means being a beacon of hope. And this is really what makes our team so special. ChatGPT can offer some really awesome referrals if you type into an AI chatbot what you need, but they are not going to connect with you like our service navigators will. It will not empathize with you. It will not hear your story. It will not validate your experience. And that is the beauty of my team, is that they truly want to help every person that calls us. And sometimes they can't, and that's equally as hard, right? So here's an example of a story of what someone might experience if they connect with 211. Joe has lost his job. 7 months ago, they're behind on mortgage and utility bills. This is causing a lot of stress. The family no longer has health insurance because the job was lost, and it's tax season, and they don't know what to do about the tax return. So at a community fair last week, Joe heard about 211 and said, okay, I'm going to call and see what's up. So my team gets this call, and we're going to start going down this list of needs, right? What we're not going to do is give Joe 14 referrals all at once, because that would be very overwhelming. Chances are they're not going to get everything wrapped around in their brain to be able to accomplish all of that. So we'll probably just start with the top two. We'll say, okay, you need mortgage payment assistance and utility payment assistance. We're going to warm transfer you to the Asian Association of Utah today to make sure you get directly connected. We'll give you the contact information for Crossroads and the Salt Lake Heat Program for your utility assistance. And then in a week, we'll follow up. So then when we follow up in a week, let's say, okay, the mortgage payment assistance covered. We got that for this month, but we didn't get what we needed from utility payment assistance. Great. Let's refer you to City of South Salt Lake instead. We'll do a warm transfer there, get you directly connected to them. And now let's address the health insurance problem now that we've gotten one of your needs crossed off on our list. And we will continue those follow-ups until the client no longer responds to us and doesn't want to talk to us anymore. So at some point, after about three times of trying to connect back with a client, we will just say, okay, if you need us, you know where we are. We won't bother you anymore. But we will work our way down all of these different needs until we feel that the client can no longer identify anything that we can help them with. Tax preparation assistance, that is actually something that on a yearly basis we offer. We work with the VITA program to be able to help people get scheduled their one-on-one meetings to help them get their taxes done. So that's something that we're able to offer on a yearly basis. You'll also notice that food resources and that tax preparation assistance are more far down the chain because those are things that people have an easier time finding on their own. So we're going to try to address those higher needs first because a lot of people know where their local food pantry is. A lot of people know how to find tax help in their community, but not necessarily mortgage payment assistance. So we're going to try to address those greater needs first. And to probably no one's surprise, our most common referral category is housing. People need help with housing. They need help finding housing. They need help paying for housing. And this is something that we have broken our team up into pods of experts, and our housing team is our biggest team because that's our largest need. So we have six folks who sit on our housing team. Our next highest need is transportation because often people need transportation to get access to the things that they need. Then we've got food and meals, then utility assistance, and then healthcare. So that is the pods that our team is broken down to based on area of expertise. But once again, anyone could take any call that comes in, and often when someone takes a housing call, it becomes a housing, food, and utility assistance call because people have multiple needs. I wanted to just throw in an example here of other types of outreach that I do. So yesterday I went to the Weber Morgan Local Homelessness Council meeting, and I just gathered some data for them that I thought might be helpful. So I went and I told them, hey, for your counties, here are your highest needs. Here are the number of people we spoke with in the last quarter, the top places that we're referring to in your area, and the top places that had positive outcomes from those referrals. And so this is something that 211, I think, is very well positioned to have a unique data set like this that is really cumulative, that says, where are we referring to? What is the success of those referrals? And regionally, what are the needs of your area? Connecting with 211, as I mentioned, doesn't have to happen over the phone. We do have a website that anyone can use to search our database. So if you had someone sitting with you and you wanted to see if you could get them connected to a resource, you could go to 211utah.org, search the website via a zip code search and see what local resources exist. So those are the resources that our team is curating. Of course, if you can't find what you're looking for online, please call us. We would be happy to help you. But this is an option for folks if a phone call feels like a bit overwhelming. Being able to just search online is an option as well. And anytime people want us to come to an event, be that an outreach event working directly with the community or more of like an educational event with organizations, there is an outreach form online. Just under our outreach and partnership tab at 211utah.org, and you can just fill in the information about who you are, what type of event you want us to come to. Also, you are just welcome to reach out to me if you have a request like this, and I will help you get connected. And if you are an organization that wants to be in our database, but you're not finding your information in our database, there is also an application online. This application does link our inclusion policy. The inclusion policy basically says you need to be either a nonprofit or a government agency. You need to offer free or low-cost services. You need to be accessible to the public.
Is it or and?
This is mostly and, but there's a lot of flexibility here. So, for example, there may be a for-profit company that fills a gap that no nonprofit is offering resources for, and we could make an exception to have that company because they're filling a space that no one else is. So the inclusion policy has all of this information about you need to be this, 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 and this, and then we end it with at the discretion of our team.
Gotcha.
And once again, this exists online, but if you are an organization or know an organization that may be interested in being in our database, you are welcome to also just reach out to me and I will get you connected with the right person after you. And we have outreach material to go out to clients in the community, tabling events, resource fairs. Links to all of these materials are available online under our outreach material tab. You are also welcome to shoot me a message and I can mail you materials if that fits your needs better. And last but not least, there is a website called 211 Counts that tracks our demographic data. So if you're curious about the anonymized demographic data from certain regions, you can go to this website and look at local and state level demographic data. This is reflected daily in terms of updates. It's also just important to remember that anytime we're talking about 211 data, this is only about the people who contact us. So I'm also consistently trying to spread awareness about 211 so that more people know to use this as a resource, gives us better data and better access for the community. What questions do people have?
Thank you, Cassandra.
Thank you. Every time I hear about all the services and everything, I learn something new about 211.
Thank you.
One of the questions I have is how are you reaching community members to let them know that 211 is available? I know a lot of folks just have no idea.
Yes. We joke internally that 211 is the best kept secret. And there are a number of things we're doing. It's part of our strategic plan to be spreading awareness about 211. One is through our providers. So we have been trying to get all of our providers like window clings that say 211 and call 211 for help, which gives our website that they can be posting on external faces of windows. We're trying to share outreach material. We go to a bunch of different like resource fairs and community events and table to try to work directly with community members and tell them about 211. So that is, word of mouth is often one of the best ways that people hear about us. So we do have like a campaign going on with UTA that where they're putting some 211 info on the like wraps on buses, which is pretty cool. Like I've got a colleague whose image is now driving around Utah on UTA buses. But word of mouth is actually the strongest way that people learn about 211.
Because that's the probably the most trusted way to, and that's what we find out. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Looks like there's a question online. Nina, go ahead.
Yes, thank you so much. That was so helpful. I have a clarifying question, and I apologize if you said it and I didn't quite hook to the answer. There was a slide you had that said determining eligibility, but then in the example that you had, I wasn't sure where in that timeline that quote, determining eligibility came into play. Could you speak to that? And I guess the reason I'm, and just to back it up, the reason I'm asking that question is because I think in some instances, individuals might feel as though if 211 is determining eligibility, that sort of then passes through to the agencies and entities that might be doing different eligibility. So how do you kind of differentiate that when you're working with a client? So thank you.
Thank you. That's a great question. Thank you so much. And I rearranged some orders of these slides, so I'm confident that it was me not communicating it quite clearly enough. As soon as we connect with clients on the phone or over chat, we're going to ask those 11 universal questions that are our baseline for determining eligibility. We have to be asked for their consent to create an account associated with their name and phone number. So if they say no, we certainly will not create an account. We ask for their consent. The purpose is so that in the future, we don't have to ask you all those same questions again. Most of the time, people say, yes, that's great. And then we ask those 11 universal questions, which answer a lot of the eligibility questions, like income, household income is included in there, children under 18 in the household, that kind of thing. So we'll ask those questions. And after we ask those questions, that's when we say, okay, why is it that you're calling us today? What is it that you need? How can we help you? And then as they dig deeper into the why of why the client is calling, then they may say, okay, now I have some follow-up questions because I know that to be eligible for SNAP, there's these few additional things that we don't ask in those universal questions. So we rely very strongly and heavily on the expertise of our service navigators who know about the resources they're referring people to know what additional eligibility questions to ask. And they're also very good about explaining why they're asking those questions. So when they're asking someone about their disability status or their gender or their income, they're explaining, I'm asking this because I want to make sure I give you a referral that you're eligible for. We'll only record it if you give us your consent to do that. But so most of those eligibility questions are happening on the front end of the call with additional ones related to their specific need.
Thank you. So you're communicating clearly to the clients, or at least making sure that they understand that you're not capturing the answers to those questions and then passing them along. So they may need to repeat the answers to those questions and further provide documentation if they do pursue certain resources, it sounds like. Okay. I see you nodding. Can I ask one more slightly different question, which is what is your approach? How do you guys handle differentiating between some of the more like urgent needs of that moment and that month versus the long-term needs? Again, going back to the example, and I recognize it's just one example, but you know, the difference between referring someone to a food pantry where they can go in, walk in and get the items and leave with them that day versus the applying for SNAP. So it's not to overwhelm people. What is your approach to that?
That's an incredible question. So first and foremost, it's going to be based on what the client has identified, right? If they call us and tell us that food is their first and primary need, then that is where we will focus. In that example, the assumption and how it built up is that they're saying the mortgage payment is their first and primary need, and that's where we would start. But by no means will we try to convince someone that their need is different than what they think that it is. Also, a lot of our team does an incredible job of trying to, for the like food pantry versus SNAP question, to do that within that same first call. So to say, okay, absolutely, you live in this zip code, there's a food pantry that you can walk to, incredible. Also, based on the questions we asked, it looks like you're probably eligible for SNAP benefits. Is that something you've pursued before? Do you have those benefits? And so a lot of times with a resource like SNAP, that's something that we're addressing within that first call. To a certain extent, that's also going to be happening then in the follow-up. So if we follow up and someone says, oh, yes, I did get my food pantry needs met, then we're going to say, okay, great. Do you feel like this is a lingering concern for you, or was this just a one-time need? So maybe they weren't eligible for SNAP, but they do feel that it's a lingering concern, and we'll say, okay, let's see what other potential options exist for you in your area. So those follow-ups are a really key part of addressing those longer-term stability as well.
Thank you so much. I've been hearing about these upcoming changes within 211 for a while now through various conversations, and it's really exciting to see how it's all mapped out. So I really appreciate the presentation today. Thank you.
No, because people will go to 211 because they need help with stabilizing basic needs that right now, and obviously they're in a situation where, they may need to keep relying on 211 to help provide them with the basic needs connections.
Yeah.
If you ever ask a question like, I don't know how to frame the question, but like, is there something that we can do to help you get out of this situation? Like, help you upscale, connect? Oh, yeah. Oh, you want to upscale? Or you want to find a new job? Or do you need help with that or something? Here's a resource. Like, you ever ask that question?
Absolutely. That is actually a really key part of switching from that information and referral model to the service navigation model, is that we're trying to leverage our partnerships, for example, with DWS. We will refer people to DWS for employment coaching. It's not something we're ever going to push on people. Most people don't call us for employment coaching. Mm-hmm. But if we're identifying that that is something that could benefit you, will we bring it up as an option and see if the client is open to being referred there? Yes. Something that is part of my job that I don't have the answer to yet is figuring out how we track that and manage that to scale for every client. So like right now in our database, we don't have check boxes that say like short-term needs met, moved on to long-term needs, moved on to full educational financial stability, right? We don't have anything tracking that, but it is a very large part of our vision and what we're trying to move towards is being able to identify, track, and support people in that long-term capacity. There's a very fine line between what we're doing in case management.
Yeah.
We manage over 60,000 client interactions a year. That is a way too large of a case manager portfolio for 16 people. But we are trying to say, okay, what case managers exist at our partner providers that we can be saying, oh, great, now that you've kind of graduated from needing us to help you get your basic needs met, we can transfer you over to Casey at UCA, a case manager who can help you in these long-term employment stability, for example. So it's a very important part of what we're doing. We don't exactly know how we're tracking it to scale yet, but yes, it's something that we're doing our best to offer to folks, because as much as you can call us every month for the rest of your life and we'll do our best to help you get connected, but we want you to feel that you're in a more stable place than that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't know that there are education opportunities that, EWS has, ability to help cover the cost of, up to $4,000 for a certification.
Mm-hmm.
People don't know that. Or if you attend Davis Tech, they have so much scholarship money out there for people that you essentially go to school for free if you wanted to.
Yeah.
People don't know that. They think they have to pay. And so to elicit them knowing, you have to ask a question. And so I'm curious if navigators ask a question to then have them be like, oh, yeah, actually, thanks for asking. I do want to go back to school or something.
Yeah, and that's something that definitely I think we have not received an increased appropriation for over 10 years now. We've received the same amount of money through the state legislature. We would love to get more to be able to expand. So if anyone wants to advocate for the 211 RFA this year, we would love that. Thank you so much. Being able to expand would get us more people to be able to do that at a greater consistency and scale.
Well, thank you so much, Cassandra, for taking the time. Is it okay if we share your email with everyone?
Please, by all means, yes.
Oh, did I also say?
And you're welcome to stay, and you're also welcome if you got a
What's on the agenda for the last bit?
We're basically going to talk about our next meeting and our retreat dates.
Okay, well, I will go ahead and excuse myself. To my folks online, thank you so much. If you have any questions, please reach out. Wonderful to see you, and thank you for having me.
So just to talk a little bit about our next meeting, so I would love for us to meet next in March to give us an opportunity to do a wrap of the legislative session. I also know that a lot of the folks who are in this meeting are going to be really busy with the session, and so I would propose that we meet next after the session. The session will end March 6th, and I would say if we could meet the following week for our next commission meeting. And so I would propose we could do, again, basically this time, so on the 10th from 1 to 2:30.
Works for me.
I'm good too.
Okay. It's not a formal motion, but...
Are you saying... March 10th.
March 10th. Yep, from 1 p.m. to 2:30. Okay. Any conflicts folks would be worried about?
Not at this time, but you never know.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen. If it's clear for now, that's the best thing to
come. Exactly.
Okay. So that meeting, Jenny will send that out to folks. And then I also want to talk about a retreat in April. Jenny, could you go to that slide? And so in April, we will have our whole commission. So as you all know, Wayne Niederhauser is off of the commission because he is no longer in charge of homelessness. There's going to be a replacement for Wayne, and we're going to be figuring out if he's going to be the replacement on our commission, or if not him, who that person will be. So we're going to be figuring that out, and then we're also going to be bringing in the new commissioner.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Is that the Multicultural Division of Multicultural Affairs choice?
No, that's the governor's choice.
I figured it's
yeah. Yeah, so the governor is going to be choosing who is going to be on the commission when it comes to homeless services. But it's in our statute that we have someone on our commission to advise us on homelessness.
Yeah, I just got my miss. I don't want to get into the politics of things.
Yeah, so we're gonna be figuring that out.
Okay.
So by the March meeting, but certainly by our April retreat, I think we will have all of our commissioners in place. And I would like us to have an opportunity to really make some clear decisions around what it is we want to work on. So in the March session, I'd like us to do a legislative recap and then also solidify the direction for our focus. And then in the April retreat, I'd like us to spend the day to really do a deep dive on exactly how we're going to be tackling that issue we're going to be working on. I think there is a tremendous opportunity for us to do incredible work around literacy. And I think in our March session, we'll have an opportunity to better understand what the legislature has passed and what are the opportunities for us to be able to work on that. I will also connect with the Bronx Partnership, and maybe they will be able to come to that March meeting or have a representative from the Promise Partnership talk to us about some of the things that they're working on that we could have overlap with. So to do that, I'd like to set a time for April retreat. Right now, the two dates that have the most votes are April 2nd and April 9th. I think the only folks who aren't on this call right now is Commissioner Ross. And Commissioner Land, you joined us, correct? Well, Commissioner Ross might be, or Commissioner Land might be muted, but we'll have most of our commissioners here, so I'd love the opportunity to just solidify that date while everybody is here. Does anyone have a preference for the 2nd or the 9th?
I like the 9th.
The ninth?
Selfish.
Yeah. And just to say...
Dude, Sean, and I was going to say I prefer the second, but whatever. Either one works.
Why the ninth, you know?
Commissioner Gardner, would you still be able to make it if it were the ninth?
Yeah, I just need to rearrange a supervision appointment. Not a problem.
Thank you. Commissioner Terras, am I saying your last name right? Is it Teferi?
Yes, that's right.
Yes, that's right.
Commissioner Teferi, does that work for you?
Yeah, I should be able to make it work.
Commissioner Medina? I know you already marked it on the sheet, but I just want to double check.
Yep, that works for me.
Yep, that works for me.
Okay.
I muted it. Could you ask that question?
Oh, Nuna, do you know if that would work for you or Tracy?
Probably more so me than Tracy, given her calendar, but April 9th feels like it might as well be in the year 2065 at this point. So I can't commit 100%, but it's looking like at least one of us can make it work.
And then Director Nye, do you know if that would work for you?
Yeah, at the moment it looks okay. I might have to rearrange a couple things, but that should be fine.
Thank you, Director Nye. And then Commissioner Lamb, sorry about that.
No, you're okay there.
Commissioner Nye's end.
I'm looking at the schedule, and I could do that April 2nd.
But you could do the one.
Fridays are my best day, but is it between the 9th and the 2nd?
Yeah, preferably between the 9th and the 2nd.
You know, the 9th is something I could definitely do.
Okay, wonderful.
Okay, thank you.
Miss anybody? Okay. So wonderful. So we have our retreat set, which is wonderful. We will finalize what we're going to be focusing on in the March session. And then I'll give you more information about where we're going to be having the retreat when we get to the March session. Okay. Any questions about that? Please get that on your calendar, and then Jenny will also be sending it out. And then as far as other business, I just want to take a moment and say that unfortunately we are going to be losing one of our star staff, which is Megan. Megan is going on to wonderful opportunities at the University of Utah. I know a lot of you have gotten to work with Megan really closely and know just what a star she is. And so she's going to be deeply missed, and we're really excited for her. Megan, do you want to say anything?
I just want to say thank you to everyone on the commission and everyone that I've gotten to know over the past 5 years I've been with the division. I've been telling people I grew up here, and I stand by it. And so, yeah, I'll be going to the University of Utah. I'll be working as an instructional designer. And so, shifting a big career-wise, so I'm excited to see what lies ahead. And I've been telling people it's not a goodbye. It's a see you later. Because I'll always be in community. So thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Wow. We're happy for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're happy for you and Sandra. Those are both true.
You got to leave them before sad, so you go.
So a lot of congratulations and wishing you the best in the chat.
Thank you. Feeling loud.
And then turn over to
I just wanted to see if we had any other questions, any other things that are going on in the community that you wanted to share before we leave each other.
This is Luna Phillips. I'm going to give a very high-level update that, in case any of you are hearing this, on the 29th of December, we at DHHS, as the designated lead agency for the state, were awarded the Rural Health Transformation Program money that was awarded across 50 states. Everybody received a slightly different amount. So we are in the very early planning stages. We still have a ways to go on getting final negotiations for a budget with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. That's the federal agency administering this. It is a cooperative agreement rather than a grant, which means that CMS will be very heavily involved in our work. We have an application of the initiatives that we are being funded to move forward on. And so excited to get that underway, and maybe at a future meeting we can talk a little bit more about that. But it's in the very early stages, and I can drop in on the DHHS website. We have a web page where we've posted our full application, a summary of the application, and our notice of award. So if you are interested, I will drop that link here and you can follow along. We'll have updates there. So just wanted to give a very high-level update on that. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Nuna. I also wanted to say that I had sent over the work that we had done when we had the Cambia grants for rural mental health workers, and I sent that along to Kendall Brockman and Michelle Geller. Just if you want me to send that to you, I'm happy to do it too, but we have an impact report on the different organizations we worked with and the community members we reached.
Yeah, it does not hurt. Send that over to us. Like I said, we've got 7 initiatives, and I don't know how familiar you are with what was ultimately put in our application and approved. So we've got 7 different initiatives, and we do have some behavioral health integration work. So send it over. You might not get an immediate response from us as we're just kind of working our way through this, getting some legislative approval on moving ahead. But always good to keep that in our back pockets as we move forward. So thank you.
Anyone else?
No, just wanted to say, Nuna, that's excellent to hear, because we had received as an agency, the agency that for my day job, rural mental health funding through MCA in the past, and we're now doing outreach into Tooele County and specifically the Wendover area, which we are just realizing is so ridiculously impoverished, and trying to just find, you know, some opportunities to continue to fund that rural health and mental health outreach. So we'll definitely be looking at that DHHS website. It's good news, because we've been scrambling trying to find stuff, have applied, and with, I think, a lot of the federal funding cuts, what we're hearing from many of the family foundations is they're just feeling super stretched because they can't, you know, they can't fit the needs of the cuts in the federal funding. And so, I just am thrilled to hear that there's looking at rural opportunities again. So thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Amy.
Anyone else? Well, if everybody's ready to get their afternoon back, can I get a motion to adjourn the meeting?
I so motion.
We get a second.
Second.
All right. We've got a motion and we've got a second. So thank you, everybody, for being there today, and looking forward to the next time that we meet. Thank you all.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Bye.